This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Please listen to verses 9 to 11 of chapter Hud from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Sayyid Ahmad Mirzadeh Waqifi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَلَئِنْ أَذَقْنَا الْإِنسَانَ مِنَّا رَحْمَةً ثُمَّ نَزَعْنَاهَا مِنْهُ لئن أذقناه نعماء بعد ضراء مسته ليقولن ذهب السيئات عني إنه لفرح فخور إلا الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير إلا الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير صدق الله
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. And if we make man taste mercy from us, then take it off from him, most surely he is despairing, ungrateful. And if we make him taste a favor after distress has afflicted him, he will certainly say, The evils are gone away from me. Most surely, he is exulting, boasting. Except those who are patient and do good. They shall have forgiveness and a great reward.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines: China accuses NATO of creating confrontation after a vow from the Western military alliance to counter what it calls the challenges posed by Beijing. India reports 60,000 new COVID-19 infections over the past 24 hours, the lowest since the end of March. Also, Palestinian factions call for a day of rage in Gaza and the occupied West Bank over a planned march by Israeli settlers in East Jerusalem al-Quds. Thank you for joining us. Well, beginning with our top story, China has accused the Western military alliance, NATO, of artificially creating confrontations with Beijing. The Chinese mission to the European Union has urged NATO to stop exaggerating what it called a threat theory against Beijing. The mission says NATO's latest stance proves to be the continuation of a Cold War mentality. On Monday, NATO leaders vowed to work together to counter challenges posed by China. They accused the Asian powerhouse of threatening the international order through assertive actions, among other things. Tensions have mounted between China and the West in recent months over a range of issues, including human rights. Now, to discuss that story further, I'm joined by Andrew Leung. He is an independent China specialist joining us out of Hong Kong. Well, China has come under a lot of pressure over the past month, especially. On the one hand, there are some allegations made by the U.S. Saying that China, actually, the coronavirus leaked from a lab in Wuhan. This was last week. Also, now NATO leaders, they have warned of the military threat posed by China, saying its behavior, or China's behavior, I should say, is a systemic challenge, and that the military alliance plans to toughen its stance toward China. And amid all this heightened tensions, a U.S. aircraft carrier group has entered the South China Sea. Now, my question is, how do you assess these threats? Do you see any truth in the allegations made by NATO or the U.S.? And also, what do you think, or how do you think China should respond?
Well, first of all, leaving aside this pandemic virus kind of thing, which is, of course, has got to be scientifically based, leaving that aside for the time being, I mean, let's concentrate on what's happening to this 360 degrees pushback against China. China has been rising rapidly as an economy, and then according to various estimates, it could overtake the United States as the largest economy in the world as early as 2028. Because of this quicker recovery from the pandemic, so it's overtaking the United States, is expected to be 5 years earlier than previously expected. But there is also the concern that with China's growing influence, it could gather more friendly neighbors to undermine the dominance of the U.S.-led global order, and then eclipsing Americans' influence in the Asia-Pacific and elsewhere. So And also, the Biden administration is aware of the weakness of the previous Trump administration and trying to rally support from its allies in Europe and elsewhere, the so-called G7, and also using NATO as another kind of platform to extend the spreading Chinese influence. In the eyes of the United States, it's a contest not only of technology or military, it is a all-integrated rivalry for power, world power. And of course, China's aim is to realize the so-called China dream. And to realize the China dream, China's economy needs to grow even quicker, bigger, and faster. But also, it needs to build up its own international influence. So inevitably, China can no longer hide and buy, as advised by a previous Chinese leader, Deng Xiaoping, because it's just growing to be too big. But then, of course, this would cause concerns in the South China Sea, over Taiwan, over Americans' influence, and indeed Americans' leadership in the world. And so you could see this kind of strategy. But I think that this strategy has been highly overhyped, according to the latest RAND Corporation, R-A-N-D, RAND Corporation report, which just came out just a couple of weeks ago, saying that the American strategy could well be over-exaggerated. But nevertheless, the RAND report, as you know, is of course funded by the highest power brokers in the United States, also recognizes China's growing impact on the Americans' led global order, and that it warns the United States to build up its own capabilities, both domestically and internationally. But then from China's perspective, China is not going to be able to replace the United States dominance anytime soon. I mean, there are not too many countries in the world who would embrace China's ideology. But nevertheless, the reality remains that China's power and influence in the world is growing quite rapidly.
Okay, and also, as you said, this rivalry and these tensions that now exist between China and the U.S., also the NATO currently, do you think these will amount to any military confrontation, or is it only some sort of political maneuvering?
Both the United States and China are nuclear-powered and also have high-speed, long-range delivery systems. So I think both sides realize that a hot war could have very dangerous and catastrophic consequences for both countries. But this does not prevent escalation of hotspots, conflicts over hotspots, into a limited war, which, of course, if not handled properly, could well have unforeseen consequences. So both sides are trying to avoid a hot war, but I think that both sides realize that this generational conflict is bound to cause a lot of problems on both sides, especially there is a kind of overhyping or exaggerated view of China's threat on the one side, and perhaps China's relative lack of understanding of some of the concerns in the West.
Mm-hmm. And does the meeting between U.S. President Joe Biden and his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin have anything to do with this?
No, naturally, because the United States has been again putting a lot of pressure on them, on Russia, and then sanctions and all that, and accusing Russia of undermining the electoral systems in the United States using cyber attacks without any evidence. And of course, Putin is greatly put off, and because of these sanctions on the on Russia, and Russia's main economy is driven by oil and gas. And the biggest customer is China. So it's naturally, Russia, to protect its own natural interests, is going to form closer and closer partnership, if not alliance, with China. And that is seen to be a kind of negative response to Western, to American-led global order. So I think that Biden is trying to talk to Putin so that at least Russia would not be such a grave enemy of the United States. But I think that Putin is likely to receive this kind of olive branch with a large grain of salt.
Mr. Leung, many, many thanks. Appreciate it. That was Andrew Leung, an independent China specialist, joining us out of Hong Kong. Now let's move on. A U.S. aircraft carrier group has entered the South China Sea amid heightened tensions with China. The U.S. Navy said the strike group is on what it called a routine mission. The Navy said the warships will be conducting maritime security operations, including flight operations and strike exercises. Washington frequently stages war games and deploys warships in the South China Sea, especially near Chinese islands. Beijing has repeatedly objected to the missions, saying the U.S. seeks to stoke tensions at China's doorstep. India has registered more than 60,400 new COVID cases in the past 24 hours. That's the lowest daily rate the country has logged since March the 31st. The new figure brings India's total caseload to over 29.5 million. The South Asian nation also reported over 2,700 new fatalities in the past 24 hours. Its overall deaths now stand above 377,000. COVID-19 surge in India in April and May, that caused daily infections to reach their peak of more than 400,000 last month. Strict lockdowns and mass vaccine rollouts have helped contain the surge. The country now has the second largest caseload and the third highest death toll in the world. The United Nations Emergency Relief Coordinator has slammed the group of seven wealthy nations for failing to come up with a plan to vaccinate the world against COVID-19.
What the G7, I think, should have done was develop a genuine global plan to vaccinate the world. It would cost, the IMF has worked out the cost of this, it would cost around $50 billion, could be paid over a period of years. That, by the way, is the deal of the century, because until the pandemic ends, everybody is going to face huge risks and potential problems. So these sporadic, small-scale, charitable handouts from rich countries to poor countries is not a serious plan. It will not bring the pandemic to an end, and it will contribute to a dangerous divergence.
Mark Lowcock stressed that the G7 completely failed to show the necessary urgency with regard to the pandemic, adding that they still have a lot to do. They said, or he said, I should say, that these developed nations should have done more to provide vital supplies, such as oxygen ventilators and testing kits, to the countries that are going to wait longer for vaccines. Separately, the World Health Organization chief said the G7 nations need to do more to deal with the global COVID crisis.
I welcome the support expressed by the G7 for WHO, the ACT Accelerator, and the idea of a treaty on pandemic preparedness and response. And I welcome the announcement that G7 countries will donate 870 million vaccine doses, primarily through COVAX. This is a big help, but we need more, and we need them faster. More than 10,000 people are dying every day. During this press conference alone, more than 420 people will die. These communities.
Tedros Ghebreyesus said Africa is the most vulnerable and needs vaccines the most. The WHO wants at least 70% of the world's population vaccinated by next year's G7 meeting in Germany. Wealthy nations' reluctance to suspend intellectual property protections has hampered the production of much-needed COVID vaccines. Palestinian factions have called for protest in the Gaza Strip and the occupied West Bank on Tuesday over a planned march by Israeli settlers in eastern Jerusalem al-Quds. Hamas and Fatah movements have urged the Palestinians to flock to Jerusalem al-Quds Old City to counter the settlers' march. Hamas has warned of renewed hostilities if the event dubbed March of the Flags goes ahead. Separately, Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Shtayyeh has warned about dangerous repercussions of the march. The Israeli media say the regime has made preparations for a possible escalation in Gaza over the march, which was originally due to take place last Thursday, but was delayed. Rabbi David Feldman says the planned march by Israeli settlers in occupied Jerusalem al-Quds is an outrageous and provocative move that could spiral out yet another round of escalation. Listen.
This is truly outrageous. This is a march which is going to take place now, planned to take place, after these marches that did take place early May, just a couple of weeks ago, and we saw, unfortunately, what the outcome was of it. So many people were killed, so much casualties, so much bloodshed, so much misery because of these reckless marches of provocation to make this statement and to fight against the Palestinian neighbors. Unfortunately, when we're talking about a day of rage, this might be a month of rage, this might be a year of rage, this is already going on for decades. This is truly outrageous. And sadly, when this is being done by this settler movement, which they come out in this religious way and they try to present this radicalism, this extremism, this terrible behavior, and they try to show this with a religious face, this is truly embarrassing to Jewish people.
Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, has hailed the end of Benjamin Netanyahu's 12-year rule in Israel, referring to him as a tyrant who has fallen. In a tweet, Zarif said Netanyahu's ouster follows several years of wars and aggression against the Palestinians and threats to the Islamic Republic. He added, the scenario indicates that while the tyrant has fallen, Iran continues the march of glory and the Gaza Strip is raising the sign of victory. The top Iranian diplomat expressed hope that Netanyahu's successors would learn that the Israeli regime, which was founded on the basis of aggression and occupation, will not last long. On Sunday, the Israeli parliament voted in favor of a new coalition cabinet, ending Netanyahu's 12-year tenure as prime minister. Journalist and political commentator Sayed Mohsen Abbas says Benjamin Netanyahu was behind numerous atrocities in the West Asian region, and if it wasn't for Iran, his balkanization plots would have succeeded.
The truth is a lot of what Israel does is through proxies, and most of, the millions of deaths across the West Asian region, the Arab region and beyond, could easily, if you wanted to really do a proper money trail or a real search of the links that all these forces have had, that have created murder, mayhem, torture across West Asia, whether it's Daesh, whether it's Al-Qaeda, whether it's the MKO, whether you want to go to any other group which has created huge, if you like, violence in the region, or, for that matter, the despots and the other tyrants like the Sisis of the world and the Mubaraks of the world over the past, from Egypt to Afghanistan, Israel has had his hand behind it, and Netanyahu, during his 12-year office, has been one of the worst culprits in unleashing these demons across West Asia. And had it not been for the Islamic Republic of Iran and its stoic resistance in Yemen, notably, Syria, notably, of course, Lebanon, and now Palestine, most recently, Iraq, not forgetting Iraq, of course, without the backbone of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Israel would have got away with its balkanization, murder, and terrorizing policies.
That's your word news for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. the supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless Thou takes it away, and leave no enemy, and leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names, in the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is his anger, and I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is his good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from thee, O patron of beneficence.
The 13th presidential election. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Iran's 13th presidential election is going to be held on June 18th. Presidential election in Iran is very important in Iran. Iran is a stable, powerful, and determining country in the region and the world. That's why the result of Iran's presidential election is of paramount importance for the media across the world. The Iranian nation has been engaged in a full-scale propaganda battle, especially after the spread of social media. The hostile social media have spared no effort to put psychological and political pressure on Iran in order to undermine Iran's elements of power and make people disappointed on participation. In view of this, the Western media and news networks have been distorting political climate and tarnishing the campaign process. These media always pursue the vested interests of their paymaster in Washington, London, and Tel Aviv. They portray a very black and desperate image of the conditions in the country and try to engineer people's minds in a bid to make them mistrust the process of election. Satellite networks in the West have always tried to say that election in Iran is manipulated in order to suggest that the whole election is ceremonial and the result of voting is known beforehand. The propaganda bombardment of the Western media is so intensive that at times the atmosphere becomes really obfuscated and recognition of right from wrong is very hard. Sometimes the Western media focus on the debates of candidates in a very selective way. In other words, they choose parts of the debates and try to create negative mentality for the audience. These media try to bold some of the concepts and direct the minds of the listeners or viewers towards certain issues with specific codes. These media, in fact, reverse the realities in a bid to pursue their own interests. The Farsi networks, like the VOA, BBC, France 24, Iran International, Manitou, and so on, are in the forefront of the media maximum pressure against the Iranian nation. In an organized battle, they try round the clock to advance their nefarious goals. These media horns try to make people disappointed about the result of election in a bid to minimize the people's turnout. They also try to make the society bipolar through forging fake polls and non-existent demands. These mercenary media incessantly try to cause civil discontent among masses, especially the youth. The media such as BBC and Iran International, which are directly funded by the British royal family and Saudi monarchic regime, respectively, have seriously concentrated on this devilish agenda. Every time that there is an election in Iran, the Western and Hebrew media start their propaganda war in order to affect the minds of people and fish in the troubled water. They exert their utmost to create an ambiguous atmosphere in the country in a bid to cause people to lose their motive for voting in the first place. Then, they make every effort to push people's minds towards a certain candidate who is more compromising and less revolutionary. Political analyst Qumars Yazdanpanah says, insinuation of people's mistrust in officials and focusing on the axes such as uselessness of their votes in the result of elections and depiction of the climate of suppression and suffocation are among the axes that these hired media have always sought. They try to damage people's trust in legal and constitutional organizations to say that elections in Iran are ceremonial and pre-planned. The Western and Hebrew media always focus on various factions and fan the flames of people's dissatisfaction with economic condition to generalize their protest to the entire Islamic system. These media also pay considerable attention to the process of qualification of the nominees by vetting bodies such as the Guardian Council. For the past three decades, these media have unanimously questioned the qualification of nominees, especially during the presidential election season. This is while in every country and ruling system, there are vetting institutions which are responsible for seeing if the nominees are qualified or not. During the elections in Iran, these hostile media shed crocodile tears for what they call breach of rights of citizenship. This way, they pursue the satanic goal of instigating civil rebellion. But they and their paymasters should know the fact that Iran enjoys one of the most, if not the most, democratic system of government in the world. This has been verified by different candidates who gain people's votes for presidency and parliament, while some of them have no belief in the Islamic Republic and Imam Khomeini's path, and have even taken anti-revolution measures. An evident example in this regard was Abul Hassan Bani Sadr, who was a puppet of the West and tried to put into effect his anti-Islamic and anti-revolution since day one that he was elected as president in early 1980. Yet, Imam Khomeini didn't dismiss him, although the Imam was religiously and constitutionally entitled to do the job. This shows the highest level of democracy and respect for people's votes in Iran.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
ugly part of Canada's hidden history made headlines in late May when unmarked graves containing the remains of 215 Indigenous children were discovered on the grounds of the Kamloops Indian Residential School in British Columbia. The grim discovery has rekindled discussion of an ominous time in the country's history.
Certainly no surprise at all. Everybody in the First Nations community knew that there are mass graves. We've been calling it for years. We've been telling the government for years that there are mass graves in every single residential school, but they didn't listen to us.
Kamloops was one out of the many residential schools in Canada designed to assimilate Indigenous children into Western culture. Around 1883, Indigenous children in many parts of Canada were forced to attend residential schools, often far from their communities.
There's nothing more painful in life than losing a child. My heart breaks today thinking of all the loving parents who never saw their children return home and who were never granted the dignity of knowing what happened.
Most of these schools were operated by churches, and all of them banned the use of Indigenous languages and Indigenous cultural practices, often through violence. Disease, as well as sexual, physical, and emotional abuse, were widespread.
Residential schools have been happening for a very long time, and it's really a tragedy for having those priests and those nuns running those schools, raping and killing and murdering and abusing those Indigenous children. And it really takes effect into all the younger generation, that intergenerational trauma. And it's really hard to move on from it.
The Kamloops School was operated by the Roman Catholic Church from 1890 until 1969, when the federal government took over the school system. Reports indicated that the students at Kamloops were severely mistreated and malnourished at times.
Many were sorely neglected and not properly fed, clothed, or housed. Others suffered physical, psychological, and sexual abuse. All were deprived of the love and care of their families, of their parents, and of their communities. These are the hard truths that are part of Canada's history.
The fact is, for many decades, Indigenous people across Canada have disappeared, suffered violence, or been killed, and the Canadian government and justice system has failed them. Sadly, this is not simply a relic of the past. To this day, the safety, security, and dignity of Indigenous people are routinely threatened, while their human rights are consistently and systematically violated.
If Canada is serious about reconciliation, we want more than words and tears. We want action, and we want a say in the control and destiny of our rights and for our children and for future generations.
Six years of hearing from nearly 7,000 witnesses to document the history of the schools show that the system was a form of cultural genocide.
I had something on my back the whole time, which is this. The culture, loss of culture, loss of language, it's dragged with me my whole life.
At the same time, the Pope has been called on to apologize for the Roman Catholic Church's role, but Pope Francis has stopped short of offering a formal apology so far, saying the sad discovery further raises awareness of the pains and sufferings of the past. According to the National Truth and Reconciliation Commission, NTRC, priests at the schools fathered infants with Indigenous students. The babies were taken away from their young mothers and killed, and in some cases, their bodies were thrown into furnaces. According to the commission, many students also died from disease, accidents, fires, and during attempts to escape. Schools would suffer mass deaths when infectious diseases swept through them. The commission estimated that at least 4,100 students had died or gone missing from the residential schools. The recent recent bombshell has once again fueled the nation's debate on how to compensate for its history of exploiting indigenous people, while many are asking how so many children could end up having a fate like these students. An estimated 150,000 indigenous children passed through the schools between their opening around 1883 and their closing in 1996.
When I heard about the 250 children who, you know, were discovered, their remains were discovered in a residential school mass graveyard, my heart was absolutely broken. I've been sort of in a grieving mode since, because not only do I grieve for them, but I grieve for my mother. She's not, you know, my late mother, because she went through a residential school and she experienced a lot of those things, and she was never able to tell her story, to tell the atrocities that she went through. The 215 the children, that's only the beginning.
The children found in Kamloops, or those who have yet to be found in other places across the country, would have been grandparents or great-grandparents, but they are not, due to deep-seated racism in the governing system of Canada.
I think that there's a lot of people in mainstream society that are unaware of the history and what happened to us, the genocide, the smallpox, all the stuff that really was very detrimental to our population.
That's why we're called survivors. We survived the torture, we survived the containment, we survived the punishment, the brainwashing that happened to our kids. That's why some of us are alive. We survived that. That's why we're called survivors. And some did not survive that onslaught done by the Crown, Canada, the churches, and corporate greed.
Amid growing outrage, the federal government said it would urgently disperse money promised 2 years ago to Indigenous communities that want to search former school sites for the remains of children. In 2019, the government promised nearly $28 million over 3 years to support, among other things, locating the bodies of children who attended the schools, but it did not honor its promise.
What they need to do is acknowledge that this was a wrong. What Trudeau doesn't want to acknowledge that it was a genocide. But there's actually been 5 genocides, the 5th one ongoing. So they need to give in and stop fighting it and compensate the residential school survivors. That's one thing. Because they had billions for COVID relief, but they didn't want to pay anything to the First Nations residential school survivors.
Indigenous people hope that the shock that followed the discovery in Kamloops would lead Canada to step up efforts at bringing about reconciliation and eliminating discrimination against them. But will the shock act as a catalyst? We have to wait and see.
The Limelight.
The House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said on Sunday, 13th of June, it was beyond belief that the 3 top Justice Department officials of Donald Trump's administration had been unaware of secret subpoenas seeking private data from the former president's political opponents. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalist Richard Luscombe. The piece is titled Pelosi Beyond Belief That Trump DOJ Chiefs Didn't Know of Secret Subpoenas. Stay with us for more. Speaker Nancy Pelosi said on Sunday it was beyond belief that 3 top Justice Department officials of Donald Trump's administration had been unaware of secret subpoenas seeking private data from the former president's political opponents. Jeff Sessions, Donald Trump's first pick as Attorney General, his successor William Barr, and the long-serving Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein have all claimed to have no knowledge of the alleged attempts by their department to harvest information covertly from leading Democrats during the investigation into whether Donald Trump and his campaign utilized links with Russia during the 2016 election, according to a CNN report. In expressing skepticism of their claims, Nancy Pelosi, a California Democrat, said on CNN's State of the Union program that the actions of a rogue Justice Department were worse than the Watergate scandal. What the Republicans did, what the administration did, the Justice Department, leadership of the former President Donald Trump, goes even beyond Richard Nixon, she said. Richard Nixon had an ending. This is about undermining the rule of law, and for these Attorney General, for Sessions at least, to say they didn't know anything about it is beyond belief. In another new development, the New York Times reported on Sunday that Donald McGahn, Donald Trump's White House counsel, was also the subject of a subpoena issued by the Justice Department. The newspaper said that Apple had told Donald McGahn last month that it had released details to the FBI of accounts he had with the company, but it had not informed him of what information was handed over to the FBI. The reason for the subpoenas was unclear, the New York Times reported, noting that a Department of Justice inquiry into a sitting White House counsel was an extraordinary move. Donald McGahn testified to Congress and to the Russia investigation led by the special counsel Robert Mueller into alleged collusion between the Trump administration and Russia. McGahn resigned in October of 2018 after falling from Donald Trump's favor by allegedly refusing the president's order to fire Robert Mueller. The Department of Justice announced on Friday, 11th of June, it had launched its own internal inquiry into the scandal, first reported by the New York Times, which the newspaper said had begun when prosecutors subpoenaed Apple early in the Trump administration as the Department of Justice was investigating apparent leaks of classified information. Their secretive inquiries were allegedly focused on at least a dozen people connected with the White House Intelligence Committee, including the Democratic members Adam Schiff and Eric Swalwell. The Biden White House on Friday called the news appalling. Former U.S. Attorney General William Barr revived the languishing investigation soon after he succeeded Jeff Sessions in February of 2019, the New York Times said, despite no evidence being found. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said Congress would instigate its own investigation and hinted that William Barr, Jeff Sessions, and Rod Rosenstein could all receive subpoenas to testify. Well, let's hope that they will want to honor the rule of law, Nancy Pelosi said when the CNN host Dana Bash asked what she would do if the trio refused to appear voluntarily. The Justice Department has been rogue under President Donald Trump in so many respects. This is just another manifestation of their rogue activity. The others were perpetrated by the Attorneys General, but this is the one they claim no knowledge of. How could it be that there could be an investigation of other members in the other branch of the government and the press and the rest to the end the Attorneys General did not know? So who are these people, and are they still in the Justice Department? Rod Rosenstein, as Deputy Attorney General, would have had authority at the beginning of the investigation because Jeff Sessions recused himself from inquiries into the Trump administration's links to Russia. In recent days, according to a CNN report, he has told people he had no knowledge of subpoenas to Apple, which were the subject of multiple gag orders to keep their existence secret. Jeff Sessions said on Friday, 11th of June, that he too was unaware, while William Barr declared on Friday that he didn't recall being briefed about it.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Saudi-led coalition is getting to the end of its tether in the face of Yemeni resistance groups, above all the Ansarullah movement. The Saudis have now to meet their nemesis at home in what many expect to be the final stages of the bloody war, not least because the Saudis and their accomplices have been enervated in a war of attrition they kindled 6 years ago. Not surprisingly, as one of their last-ditch attempts to save face, the Saudis are now busy issuing denials of heavy defeats on the front lines, and at the same time fabricating feats for their crestfallen forces. fighters from the popular committees released new videos of a major operation carried out on May 28th against the Saudi Kingdom's forces and mercenaries.
The operation was quite exceptional because it was extremely well fought. It is on the territory and high ground that the Saudis were in control of, and the large number of Saudi and Sudanese and other Yemeni who support the Saudis and are considered as a mercenary, the large number and the high equipment quality that they had did not prevent Ansarullah from occupying it.
The Yemeni's Al-Masira television channel reported that in the operation, sensitive targets were hit across the three strategic mountainous areas of Jabal Abdud, Al-Rami, and Jahfan in the southern Saudi region of Jizan. According to the report, more than 80 mercenaries were killed, and at least 32 armored vehicles were damaged. The Yemeni forces reportedly managed to take full control of dozens of sites in the Saudi region after the mercenaries, who included Sudanese forces, were pushed back. Yemeni forces managed to seize control of at least 40 sites in the mountainous region, after which the Saudi Air Force sent warplanes that inflicted damage on their own military equipment. Given the recent achievements in southwestern Saudi Arabia, Yemen's Supreme Political Council has announced that the Yemeni side is prepared to exchange the bodies of those killed during the operations with Saudi Arabia. The Yemenis have stepped up their retaliatory attacks on Saudi Arabia in recent months, saying they will continue unabated as long as Riyadh carries on with its bombardment and blockade.
We saw the number of the Houthis was inferior to the number of the people the Saudis and the Sudanese and the other occupying the position. And that also another lesson to learn from the military tactic point of view. And we saw that the light infantry can really defeat highly equipped forces when they're not motivated, they are not the owner of the ground, and they are there because they've been told that they want to occupy a foreign territory. However, we saw from Ansarullah Houthis that they are the owner of the ground, and this is what permit them to think less about the sacrifices they need to undergo in order to recover their own territory and liberate it from the Saudi occupation.
Meanwhile, the spokesman for the Yemeni Armed Forces, Brigadier General Yahya Sari, recently announced that the army troops and allied fighters from popular committees have hit sensitive targets in King Khalid Air Base in the Saudi city of Khamis Mushayt, some 884 kilometers south of the Saudi capital, Riyadh. The overnight attack was carried out by two of the country's domestically developed Qassam 2K, Stryker 2K combat drones. Earlier this year, Yemen's Air Force carried out a number of operations against sensitive and important sites in Saudi Arabia, including Abha International Airport.
This is was very clear that there is an axis of the resistance that is coordinating its knowledge at passing on information and sharing experiences. The attack that Ansarullah carried out reminded me of the same attacks Hezbollah used to carry out against the Israeli occupation of the south of Lebanon in the 90s. However, now today, with modern equipment, with anti-tank missiles, and with more advanced knowledge on how you occupy a high ground, particularly from the war that Hezbollah was engaged in Syria to liberate the Syrian territory from the Takfiri extremists. And we saw this happening on the Syrian-Lebanese borders. We saw this happening in the Kalamun area in Syria. And we saw exactly the more or less the same reproduction in Jizan and on high ground. Therefore, the simple conclusion is there is a shared experience among the axis of the resistance, and Ansarullah are part of this axis, and they are learning from those members who have been through the same experience, and they implementing it, and it resulted successfully.
In one of its latest articles, Foreign Policy has analyzed the situation in Yemen, saying Yemen's popular Ansarullah movement won the U.S.-sponsored war waged by Saudi Arabia, stressing that the losers are now in no position to dictate terms to the victors. It said Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman launched the offensive on the assumption that it would bring an easy victory. Instead, it became a public relations debacle